Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. Go to MUBI.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial of Mubi. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined today by Michael Snydell.
Hello.
And Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah.
I'm like here. Five blocks away from Wrigley Field right now, guys, so if you hear deafening. I think they've lost both days this week already, and then, yeah.
Well,
I super pay attention to it, obviously.
Yeah, no, I've been too wrapped up in fucking election shit and then my own life to really be able to know what the hell's going on with baseball. I was shocked to find out that football season is apparently in full swing.
Oh.
So, you know where I'm at. I am okay. Not a sports guy in the moment. So, we are here today to talk about Moonlight.
So not sports?
Not sports. We are here to talk about Moonlight, the new film by writer-director Barry Jenkins. And that's why we're playing the Moonlight Sonata. So enjoy that.
It's very pretty.
Very pretty. We are here. It is All Hallows Eve Eve, the day before Halloween. Guys, are any of us dressing up wearing costumes?
Yep.
Bill, please tell everyone what your costume is going to be, because I really like it.
So it's Sam from Trick or Treat, and
nice.
I recently, they had a company officially license the mask and like the whole outfit for Trick or Treat, so they got with like the production crew and made like a very, very screen accurate mask, so I have the Sam underneath like pumpkin head.
Oh, so you're not Sackboy Sam.
I'm going to be Sackboy Sam before while I introduce the film, and then after the film I'm going to be running around in my reveal costume.
Oh, nice.
That is some nightmare fuel right there, Bill.
Yeah, I wore it to work out. I do CrossFit, and we like all got together and like had like a Halloween like workout kind of party thing. Yeah, it's weird. It's a cult. Anyways,
thing that I've ever heard.
I was wearing the costume, and it is not workout friendly. It is very sweltering. The mask is full latex, and yeah, every time I looked at someone though, they were like, "You gotta stop looking at me. That's creepy." I was like, "Yes, effect achieved."
Awesome. All right. Well, we are brought to you today by Mubi. That is the streaming online cinema where you can see some of the best foreign and independent films every month. They release a new film each day, and you have 30 days to watch it. If you've been listening to this show, you will know that for 2 weeks now, I have been pumped up about the fact that I will finally get to see a movie that I've wanted to see for possibly a decade. I honestly can't remember when I first found out about this film. It's called, I believe, because it's a Belgium film, and I think they're speaking French, it's Calvary, or Calvaire, I don't know, but I watched it. I finally watched it, and, oh boy, much different than I was expecting in a good way. And
is this more on the atmospheric or gory side?
Definitely atmospheric, and then it doesn't get gory, but it gets super uncomfortable. So yeah, I finally watched it. Whew. Anyway, so if you would like to go to Mubi and see the things that they have coming out during Horrific October, which is happening right now, you can go to mubi.com/filmstage for a free 30-day trial. And check out Calvary, just or Calver, or I know that the English translation is The Ordeal. You're not going to be disappointed if you're a horror fan. You're gonna dig it. So check that out. Again, that's mubi.com/filmstage. Fucking have fun, guys. We still don't have a tagline. You can also find us on Twitter at Filmstage Show, on Facebook, The Filmstage Show, and email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And don't neglect to give us a star rating and a comment on iTunes, because that helps people find us somehow. I don't know. We also just love getting feedback. We are sluts for attention. Woo! So, guys, that's about it. Nothing else to talk about. Are we ready to talk about Moonlight?
Sure.
Yeah.
So much enthusiasm. All right. That, again, is Moonlight, the newest film from writer-director Barry Jenkins. And this film stars... Marisala Ali is the guy who I'm going to be happiest of talking about, as well as Janelle Monáe. And then we have three different people who are playing the main character of Chiron. And I'm just gonna wait until we actually get to them to start reeling off their names. So here is the trailer for Moonlight.
What you looking at me like that for? What, man? Come on, you just drove down here? Yeah.
Who is you, Sharon?
For a long time, try not to remember.
That is the trailer for Moonlight. This is a film that has been impossible to get away from the buzz for. People are already calling it one of the best of the year, amongst many, many other great things. A lot of superlatives being thrown in this movie's direction. So let's find out what we thought of this movie. I would like to start with Bill Graham. What are your basic all-around thoughts on Moonlight?
So this film came in with a lot of hype. After the Oscar So White kind of situation, I was listening to someone and they were talking about how this film was running into kind of an issue of, or not an issue, because obviously Oscar voting and everything like that haven't happened yet, but they were basically saying that the potential issue for this film is that it wants to be two things at once. It wants to be a African-American film, and it also wants to be a gay film. And they were basically pointing out that the Academy may balk at the idea of a film trying to be both. which is a crazy idea. Yeah, that's, you know, all these old white people. Yeah, you know, I guess that's kind of legitimate, you know. It makes sense, especially in the wake of Oscar So White and everything like that. But this film is point blank. It is beautiful. It is gorgeous to look at. The music, the lyrical quality of how it's shot, everything just kind of combines to just make this kind of really artistic and yet accessible film. It blends those two kind of characteristics that aren't usually very easy to blend well. It maintains a very strong narrative And because it's so specific, I think it actually becomes more universal than it otherwise might be, because you get to know these this one character mainly so well in a way. Even though he lacks a lot of dialogue, he says more with his actions and how he presents himself and things like that. And it's really kind of a character study of both him and the people around him. It mainly takes place in Miami, with a small kind of stint in Georgia for a little bit. But for the most part, it's pretty much this kind of rundown area of Miami that is just a fascinating slice to kind of look into and see and be aware of. I was privileged enough to get to interview one of the stars, Trevante Rhodes, and he mentioned something during one of the Q&As that I was listening in on, and he mentioned that there, at least according to him. Now, I haven't watched it twice to kind of look through, and it's not even a film that I necessarily want to actually confirm or deny this, but he said that there isn't a single white person on screen, which struck me. It kind of flabbergasted me, because I mean, even if he said that and it's not 100% true, even if it's, you know, there's one or two people in the background, it's fascinating to realize that it didn't even faze me. I didn't even notice it. I think it's a very powerful love story. And I really, really loved it. I love the triptych style of the storytelling here. And some people will kind of compare this to Boyhood and things like that, because it is kind of a coming of age film. I think it's much more lyrical than Boyhood, but of course Boyhood had like twice the runtime. So, yeah, that's my feelings on it.
When you say it's more lyrical than Boyhood, but Boyhood had twice the runtime, what are you trying to say there?
I'm saying a longer film generally is going to be tougher to make lyrical and also be something that you can sit through. Okay. I mean, can you imagine if Boyhood was filmed in kind of this same way and it was 3 hours still? It would, for some people, it would just be maddening, right?
Sort of like Elephant by Gus Van Sant couldn't be that long.
Sure.
Mm. Yeah, because it's got that dreamlike quality. All right, Michael Snydell, what did you think of Moonlight?
Well, guys, I've been struggling with this one for a little while. I got to see it about maybe a week and a half ago, and my first blush impression was that I liked it, but it wasn't living up to the hype. And that's weird to say, because there's so many components and elements of this that I really like. I think the performances are pretty much comprehensively excellent, with a few small nitpicks. I think that the direction is really excellent. I think that the cinematography and the way that these characters, you know, they dominate the screen. But it's so, I'll kind of co-opt Bill's word, lyrical here. And, you know, to play, you know, the name game again, I couldn't help but think of something like Carol as well. Not in terms of it being a queer love story, but in as much being said in what is not being said. But my overall thoughts are that this film just didn't quite gel for me in terms of how the triptych of perspectives communicated with each other. And I this movie absolutely it really it really appealed to me on a level of being a story of homophobia. This is not that I want to say I experienced obviously the same life experiences of this person at all, but the homophobia and that aspect and playing a person that you aren't, those were things that really, really moved me and were very honest. But there, you can tell I'm just having difficulty even articulating it even a week later. It's just that it's something about the film just doesn't quite stick with me. I think it needs either another draft, or I need to be able to go into it with a different relationship to understanding the source material. One thing that's interesting to mention here, and I'm sure we'll get into it more, is that this is originally based on a play by Terrell McCraney, who not sure if it was an off-Broadway or Broadway play or where it was set, but there is a definitely, at least in my opinion, there's a weird, complicated relationship between Moonlight sometimes feeling very cinematic and also sometimes feeling very, very... like a schematic that we're following. And it's those two things. I just couldn't reconcile those two differences. So I think this is a good movie, but I just can't get behind The Rapturous Praise.
Yeah, the Rapturous Praise. I don't know about the people who listen to this program, but I'm definitely in the thick of film Twitter. And as such, it's just not possible to go through a day without seeing like 10 mentions of Moonlight and how good it is. And I think that that can be really damaging for a film. Luckily, cynical asshole that I am, I like can't trust that level of hype. So I don't allow myself to become hyped anymore. I've gone through too many cycles of, oh, everyone says this is really good, and then I hate it, to really allow that to elevate my expectations. I keep my interest in a film hopefully cordoned off to the point where it's just, I know that I want to see this film. It interests me. This movie, it was harder to keep that hype away just because it was so deafening. And thanks to the collapse of Birth of a Nation, this movie became one of those things that everyone in the culture and, you know, awards watchers are talking about, because they really, really want to have another black film with black artists.
It's not only Birth of a Nation. I think that's a little bit,
I mean, it's
unfair.
It's,
I would agree,
like,
that it's,
if
definitely,
Birth of a Nation had been successful, no one would talk about this. I think that this is still it. But I feel like there's, from the podcasts and the awards coverage, which, God, it's not even November yet and there's already awards coverage. You can definitely feel that nervousness. Like, they want it to succeed. And so when it does, to them, they're going to start speaking about it more and more. So I went into the movie basically just, you know, whatever the review said. I didn't read a single review about this beforehand. I only saw the ecstatic tweets and headlines. And I gotta say, you know, it's a fine movie. Don't worry, this isn't gonna be another camera person where I can't think of anything to say, so I just keep saying it's fine. I definitely don't know. I'm gonna try to keep my reaction to the hype away from it. But I will just begin by saying that I don't understand where that hype is coming from, given the movie that I saw. I have a personal thing against movies that have a protagonist that doesn't speak a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a passivity that I think on a raw human level, like, I don't like people like that. I don't like people who don't speak. I don't like people who can't say what's on their mind. And
it's interesting you mentioned that, because one of the things that I had an issue with one of the child actors in Birth of a Nation was that the kid said, I think, all of like two words in that entire film. if you know what I'm talking about. You remember what I'm talking about?
I believe so, yes.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that, because that was definitely something that bugged me on that film. And yet here, I wasn't as bothered by it, but I'll let you continue.
Well, there's a cinematic shorthand for like pensive, introverted child that, you know, in everything, there's just like, if a kid isn't speaking and they're just like quiet and reserved, we're supposed to like infer depths. And I'll say that this child actor, we're gonna call Sharon throughout. Sharon, I just listened to
Sharon.
Sharon,
yeah. So we're gonna call Sharon throughout his life by the names that are given to his chapters. So the first,
I guess, is actually Chiron.
Chiron. Yeah. So in the first chapter, he's referred to as Little. So I'm going to call youngest Chiron Little. So Little is played by Alex R. Hibbert, and he plays that character well, but it's not, to me, a compelling character, especially the way that it's done in this film, where you put him up against a gregarious, like, super altruistic, just nice guy who, like, is the type of guy who seemingly can't stop talking.
So Juan, is that who you're referring to right
Juan,
now?
Who's played by Marisol Ali.
Yeah.
And he's great. Like, I loved him in this movie.
Yeah.
And I've loved him in many things that he's done previous to this. Things like House of Cards, The Place Beyond the Pines. I mean, apparently he's
killing it in Luke Cage as well.
I have not
seen
that.
I don't even like Luke Cage,
but he's killing it.
Yeah, I just remember, like, he plays Boggs in The Hunger Games. A wholly forgettable film series, but I still really liked him in it.
Sure.
He was apparently in Predators too, and I don't remember that. Ooh. But again, a wholly forgettable thing. But he's great, and he is so magnetic. And to have him playing off of this silent child, it just, like, every bolt of lightning that Ali was putting out, Hibbert, I assume his writing and direction was just, well, don't respond to it. Like, you're the type of kid who doesn't respond to this.
Yeah.
And so, like, finally, as he starts to open up, I'm like, thank God, like, this is happening. Like, now we can get to the real heart and soul of this. But then you go to the next. And I think that that's a problem with the way that this movie is structured, where, unlike Boyhood, where you're following the same people throughout 12 years, and you're seeing, like, maybe, I don't know, 10 minutes of their life for every year. And so you're tracking them. This one makes huge jumps. And so you just can't, it doesn't work as much. I will say, however, that Chiron, played by Ashton Sanders in that high school section, does pull off the pensive, quiet thing a lot better. And I was able to connect with him more. But then, I don't know, like, it's just, it was really hard to, like, track through this movie, because the sections themselves are so brief in their story time, if not the actual time that they're on screen. And I don't feel like the movie is making a big effort to follow along as much as it should. And then that's to say nothing of pretty cliched plot points that keep coming up.
I just wanted to mention this, because this just reminded me of this, is what is so unusual, not just in, you know, the narrative movements, but in the way that this thing is structured, is that sometimes it feels so fluid in terms of the way that conversations move. And other times I feel like I'm just being, you know, bracketed into this story, where I'm just like, no, just let it breathe.
Right.
So there's that weird back and forth, in the sense of the direction, you know, It wants to bring up the full experience and the understanding of what this kid is going through. But as you're saying, we're just kind of being shuttled off. And I had a really hard time, just like you, with trying to track that.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll say there's some great stuff within this. I think that the scene where Little learns to swim, the dinner table mm-hmm. conversation that kind of mm-hmm. closes out Little's whole arc.
Janelle Monáe is so good in this.
Oh my God. Janelle Monáe is amazing. And I was shocked at looking her up as an actress on IMDb and seeing how little she has been in.
Great musician and a great actress.
Yeah. I mean, I need more of her in my life. And like her work in this has made me want to see Hidden Figures, because even though I think it's really just a trailer and the fact that Kevin Costner's in it, like I see that movie and I'm like, I've seen that movie before and there's no need to watch it again. But because of her and the fact that she's in it, I'm like, all right, I'll give that a run. But I don't know. There's not enough in between the moments of truth to really keep it going. Like it's not like, you know, for some reason, for whatever reason, I kept thinking, this isn't a movie where like a lot of big things happen. So it's not like Sicario where like there's gun battles and, you know, drug trafficking. This is just like a human life that I'm observing. And I kept wondering, like, why do movies by Steve McQueen that tend to do that same thing kind of ratchet me in more? Like, why am I watching Shame and I'm riveted the entire time, even though it's just a guy who likes to have sex too much, like who's a sex addict? Like, that's not an inherently compelling thing. And I think it has a lot to do with the filmmaking and the general sense of pace and the fact that you're like dug like a tick into this person's life for a comparatively short period of time, but with so much detail that you can't help but get drawn in. And the problem with this movie is that every time I felt that happening, suddenly it would smash to black and we'd jump forward. And then all I wanted was to explore more of this life, but that wasn't the intention of the movie, at least not in the way that it was being presented. So I don't know.
This movie like relies on that unknowability to a certain extent, and that's difficult.
Right. Like, I mean, we can talk about it in spoilers. We'll do a brief spoiler section, but like every time that something would happen where suddenly I was like, this is what I need, it would go away. And so it was almost like we were getting the stuff that you would cut out of your memoir on top of like the thing that would finally get you to the point where you'd be interested again, and then it just stopped. And again, like there's cliche in here that I feel like a movie that is tackling these things ought to try to get away from. Like the whole of his relationship with his mother is so divided from everything else that is happening. And like poor Naomi Harris just has to like run through the gamut of like cliched, poor drug addicted mother cliches, and it was awful to watch. And it was, there was things that could have happened in those spaces had she just not been there.
I do have to butt in because this is somewhat based on Barry Jenkins and Terrell McCraney's life. Mm-hmm. This is loosely based around their life, even though they basically grew up blocks away from each other and yet didn't know each other until recently. And this is something that I think the reality of the situation that this film is portraying, this film, listening to Barry Jenkins and listening to other actors talk about making this film, it's not necessarily, oh, it's a cliche and things. Some cliches exist because they are actually reality, right? Yeah. Because they do happen frequently in our real world. And I think this is one of those cases where it's unfortunate because that cliche has been played out, and it's been played out in fictional narratives, whereas this is loosely based around their kind of lives growing up in this area. In fact, growing up in Miami. And so if you're going to, and look, I totally understand where you're coming from, Brian, but at the same time, this is one of those things where it sucks, because the reality is that this is the reality that they were kind of dealing with, which is why they were able to get Naomi Harris, who has been very vocal about the fact that she didn't ever want to play a crackhead, right? Sure. That was one of the things that she set out in her career. She very adamantly stated that to begin with her career was that she never wanted to go down certain roads, certain cliches. And she got offered this part, and it was how personal it was to Barry Jenkins and Terrell that sold her on the fact that she was willing to play this character, because she felt like this was an opportunity to kind of tell a story, their story, and they didn't have that ability. You know, they're both males and not actors. it's unfortunate, because I think there are a lot of cliches that are kind of revolving around this story in particular, and some of the things that happen to these characters. And yet, at the same time, having done a little bit more research into kind of the reality around the film, it's just the simple reflection of their world.
But that's,
you know,
not enough for me. Like, you're
that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, but I guess there was a part of me that was considering the conversations that have been happening, not just around representation in cast, but also in creator, I was hoping to see more in this movie. Like, I wanted to see things that I didn't feel like I could find anywhere else. But when you come down to it, you know, like, really little Chiron and Black are like the only three characters, and they're all one character that you wouldn't see in any other movie. I didn't feel like there was new breakthrough here.
Besides the dealing with masculinity in the African American space gay identity,
like,
and things like that.
I'm purely talking about, like, character wise. Like, I was hoping for, like, the arc that, again, Chiron in all of his permutations goes through is interesting, but the people that surround him are not particularly so. They're not anything new, or like they didn't feel more.
So authentic. Juan wasn't interesting.
He was interesting because of his,
and then Teresa,
performer.
Uh-huh.
Right, but that doesn't make him an inherently interesting character. It's like, you have, here's the drug dealer, and then here's his
I think he's got more dimension than just being a simple drug dealer,
right,
and same with her.
I'm hoping that this movie is going to give people an opportunity to see more than what we have seen previously when a film decides to explore Black experience. And while we do get that through Chiron, again, it, all three of him, it's not surrounded by anything more than the usual cliches that we usually get, which for me was a pretty big letdown.
I don't know if I'd quite agree with that. I mean, I think that, yeah, I mean, when it comes to the individual cliches, they are there, as both of you have mentioned, you know, with Naomi Harris's character. But you know what, I did, maybe it's not new dimensions, but the ways that this film combines, you know, her realization that her son is gay, or or the fact that Juan is this father figure, or I should say this, yeah, this multifaceted thing, that Juan is a father figure to Chiron, but also that he's am I going to get into spoilers here? That he is, can I just say it here, guys?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's got multiple.
He's dealing, that Juan is dealing to his mom, to Chiron's mom.
Yeah, I would say
those.
Spoiler.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's not a spoiler.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say there is that I think the way that those things are folded in do provide a new perspective.
I agree. Yeah.
But I do think it's less – I actually don't really have a problem with that first act, but I do have a similar problem to Brian in the sense that it's the arcs of these characters to me – that were more disappointing than, you know, them being characters that I'd seen somewhere else, even if they were more fleshed out. Again, like if you take Juan out of this, like a drug dealer character who, you know, who also has a noble side, who has, you know, you can go as easy as something like Omar. You know, there's any number of things you could point to in pop culture where that's there. But it's
Omar
very
from the
different.
Wire?
Yes.
He wasn't a drug dealer, though.
Okay, fine. He's not a dealer, but he is a. Fine. Let's put it this way: someone with a code. How about this?
He's got to have a code.
Someone who does unsavory things, but also is constantly thinking about that. I do think those things, as you're saying, I do think that is bringing in something new, but those do start hitting on a few notes where I'm like, okay, you I'm about to jump into speculation, but when the film is not hitting those familiar notes, it is weirder when it goes into things where, you know, his mom, you know, cycles through moments of when she's high and when she's not. Like some of those things, just the way that they come back, it starts to feel less fleshed out. The more you think about by the end how these characters fit in, it starts to feel less like characters and more like touchstones on a journey.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I said something similar to this earlier, but listening to you, Mike, I mean, this movie really does feel like, you know, we know what the catalyst for change will be, but we have decided not to show the change occurring. We're just going to jump to the change having happened. And I feel like those spaces in between would yield richer material than the material that this movie is going through.
I think to me that sounds like it would be an awful waste of screen time to see the process. I don't need to see the process. You can give me the before, you can give me the after, and we can move on with this character story. I think it sounds like you want to see that change happen on screen, and to be honest, I'm not very interested in that. I'm interested in the catalyst. Yeah. I'm interested in seeing him after the fact, seeing the change have already happened, and then we get to explore who he is currently. And I think that's part of the reason why I connected to this film is I don't need to see the process so much. I don't need to follow the same character as he's growing through. I need to see those moments that are for him hugely important to his identity, right? Each one of these moments are, you know, you mentioned Juan, and Juan is a huge part of his life growing up. You mention the second part when he's a teenager. That's him finally. So much happens in that second part. There's so much that happens. It is.
That's a great section.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're actually praising something here, because
I've been praising a couple things. I think most of my praise has been centered on the middle part, though, because I said that Ashton Sanders is like amazing in that, and
sure,
I don't want to get into spoilers, but Well, you said I haven't praised anything. Like, I've praised many performances.
I'm talking about mainly the narrative, and the narrative in that second part is definitely fantastic. The journey it goes through. I mean, look, if we got mainly the second part and then it ended on the third part, I think this would be probably a better film in a way. I think if you smash in kind of some of the better parts of Little's storyline, I'll be honest, I had an issue with how little he talked. Little talks. I definitely understand the frustration with the first part. I think mainly there, it's the characters around Little that I found most interesting, and I was willing to latch on to Chiron for that journey to get to the second part with Ashton Sanders, where it really, for me, it solidified into a film that I was very much interested in watching how it was gonna unfold and things like that. But I mean, even in the first part, there's crucial little moments that I think are necessary. And then, you know, by the time we end up with Black in the third part, I think that journey is worth seeing through. And I think it stays with Black almost. I think our journey with Black is pretty much on the same time scale as his life. Right. We don't have any big jumps. We're pretty much staying a day in the life of Black.
Yeah. And it seems like it maybe takes place over the course of 2 days.
Yeah. So it's very quick. We don't get big narrative jumps at that point. We basically catch up with him and we finish the film with him kind of in the same sequence. And I think that for me benefited because it was able to show me a lot of things, either resolve or how, you know, break them down and then build them back up. I think some of the performances from Rhodes in particular in that third part are just fantastic. The scene in the diner for me is just an absolute highlight. And I think all of that is one of the reasons why I really, really enjoy this film. And, you know, I would say that it is unique, and look, that triptych format is tough to break through. It's tough to try and find a balance of how much you want to tell each story and things like that. But I don't know. I really think Jenkins found a really, really good balance between all of this. So, definitely won. I'm not even gonna.
I think it's Marisol Ollie. Yeah,
we'll just call him Ollie for now. He is fantastic. He's great. Really is.
It's funny, Bill, because I actually, if I were to rank the sections of this film in terms of like what I feel I got out of them and how successful they were, I would definitely go middle, beginning, end.
Interesting.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah, I found the end to be just really, really underwhelming, and I would have preferred, honestly, to have just like spent more time in the first and second and just flesh out the movie that way. Just, and you could end it in the same place that the second ends, and I still would have felt okay with it. But yeah, that third section, for whatever reason, just like it didn't really do it for me. I feel like that point especially is the place where I need more than what was given, and the process to get him there may have been more interesting to see, or even just seeing him living more of his actual life before we get to this kind of interlude that he decides to take would have been, I guess, more narratively fulfilling for me.
I think one thing, I actually quite like the third part. It's probably two. No, it might actually be 3-2-1 for me if I was going to rank them.
Okay.
One thing that I do think you know, actually a friend I was with mentioned this too, is that they had difficulty believing that, Ashton Sanders, the 16-year-old Sharon would become Trevante Rhodes, which I don't know whether I have that same problem, but
Are you saying in terms of character, or are you saying just in terms of looks?
No, it's not really looks.
I did feel like their fidelity to possible future physical look definitely deteriorated the most in the third section.
Sure. And even Trevante, like listening to him, he was talking and he was like, yeah, I don't look anything like Ashton. Yeah. But he said he thought he looked similar to Alex. In fact, when he saw the film for the first time, I don't know if y'all know this, but they weren't allowed to interact with each other before filming. And in fact, they didn't interact at all. And so Barry just wanted them to each come in with their individual parts and just kind of act it out like they thought they would. And so the fact that they all have this kind of shy, they constantly avert their eyes and they look down. The fact that they all three did that, I don't know how much was in the script specifically about that, but you know, they were all three pretty surprised when they got together at Toronto and were like, hey, we did a lot of the same things. That's weird. So, what was I mentioning? What was the last thing we were, the looks of them.
I was going to say it's not the point about what his friend was saying.
I'm sorry.
It wasn't looks.
It's not really looks. It's just that I sense a self-consciousness in the continuity here that did distract me. And you know, there was those connections, as you're saying, like how both Trevante and Ashton and Alex all, you know, avert their eyes when you know, confronted by someone and things like that. But there is a jump that's required between Ashton and Trevante that isn't always obvious and feels even stranger in, or not feel stranger, but there's just, I just have a hard time not feeling like this movie is biting off too much. And that feels so weird because obviously it's a story that's meant to, you know, fold in all of these things that, you know, going through, coming out and accepting your own, you know, sexual identity. You have the race issues, you have dealing with black masculinity and all of these things. But it's just, there's such a weird combination of neatness and not dissociation, but it's so purposefully disjointed, but also so neat in the ways that it wants to call back to those early parts. And I still think that makes it hard for me to view these three people as a single person. And I think that's why maybe the accumulating emotion doesn't quite work for me, even though each of those segments, I'm feeling, you know, each of those big moments.
Do we want to go into spoilers so we can talk about those big moments a little bit?
Sure.
Sorry, I guess we didn't really get to talk about Trevante without spoilers. I'm just...
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, it's an unfortunate thing having to do with the way that the film is set up. And actually, you know, again, not to talk too much about awards and stuff, but people have brought up the fact that, like, this movie, while it wants, like, the type of movie that would get a lot of awards, it's also the type of movie that might screw itself over for getting some awards because you have three leads and, like, which one, like, who gets the most attention? Mm-hmm. Like, does the film throw its weight behind, or I guess the producers throw their weight behind one of them, but not the others? So yeah,
I feel like it's Trevante and Andre Tallant. If I was going to speculate, that would be my guess. As best Andre and supporting.
Holland? Oh yeah.
Andre
yeah.
Holland played Kevin.
Kevin.
I was going to say, I would love to see Marisol Ali up there.
I think unfortunately his narrative is just too short in the film itself. It's done on purpose, but certainly I can see there have been characters out there with less screen time that have made
some doubt.
Yep. so, you know, there's precedence for him getting a nomination, and you're right, he comes in and he is just a firestorm. He lights up the screen. I love watching that guy. He's fantastic.
So I would say, before we jump into spoilers, because I really want to, now that we're talking about Mahershala Ali, I would say I'm not like negative on this film. I would say it's like a solid C+, B-.
Oh wow.
Well, that's not negative.
No, but that's certainly not a very good score. A C plus.
I guess so. I mean, yeah. Let's be.
I don't know. We're trying
B is
to
a passing grade. So
sure, yeah.
And
I don't know what a pass is though. Watchable.
I would say like a C+ is like it's a fine film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then B- is like it's a very fine film, and then B is like it's a good film, and then B+ is it's a very good film, and then when you start getting to the A's, you're like, oh man, get your top 10 ready because this is where it's at.
I would absolutely recommend a B-. I'm just saying.
Yeah, and a C+ for me is when I'm like, I don't know if you'll like it, but I have to start thinking about it. But like a B-, a B plus, I'm like, yeah, you should see it. And then in the A territory is where I start shaking you and like yelling at you for not having seen it yet. So, I would say that this is a movie worth seeing for the performances that I mentioned, and just to make up your own mind, because there is a lot there. And, you know, like I said, some of the characters are cliche, but you're not probably going to see another film that tackles this type of main character like this for a while, and that's definitely something to look at.
Well, I hope it'll be sooner than hopefully, you know, more filmmakers will be emboldened.
Here's the thing, if it's not a superhero,
studios should be more emboldened to bankroll things like this.
If it's not that's what A24 like lives for. But I just, you know, anytime that a movie comes out that's not about a fucking superhero, I'm like, you know, go out and see it, because you're probably not going to see something like this for a while. It could be just about like a rogue cop, and I would still say like, well, you're probably not going to get one of these for a while, because he doesn't have a cape and rocket boots. So now that we're in spoilers, I wanted to say that like that scene.
Wait, are we all going around to say whether we should watch this?
Bill is like super positive.
Yes.
So I thought that his was obvious. I just wanted to clarify mine, because like Bill said, I hadn't appeared to say a lot of positive things. But Mike, would you say that this is something people should see?
I'm at a B-. Yes, I think people should see it. I don't think it all quite holds together, but yes, I think people should see it.
Awesome. Okay, so now that we're in spoilers, that dinner table scene with Mahershala Ali as Juan and Little and Teresa is like punishing in the best way, in the way that this movie, I think, desires to be often and rarely achieves. And you couldn't get that without the performances that happened before then. And that's why I won't say like, you know, Alex Hibbert's a terrible actor, because
sure.
He's obviously doing what he's asked. And in that scene, he is like, you just want to wrap him up and protect him. And the way that it ends with him leaving and Juan, like having the barest flicker of a breakdown was just awful. Like in a good way, obviously. It's difficult to watch and not have an emotion.
It was Yeah, it was narratively satisfying in a way that's just like a gut punch.
Right. What's not narratively satisfying is coming back with Chiron and then having Wanbi passed away and like
that. Oh, I kind of loved that, actually.
I did not. Okay, this is kind of what I was hoping. I wanted this, and this is just what I was feeling from the movie, especially at the end of that first act. I kept feeling like this was going to be a movie of discovery and letting go. So I was almost certain that, like, this kid thought he found a friend, and then he didn't, and then he walked away and never spoke to them again. Like, I thought that was going to be, like, his clean break. And then, you know, going off of that, he would never speak to Kevin again at the end of the second one. And I thought it would be, like, him discovering and then letting go of people who aren't what he actually needs. And that's not what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the fact that he apparently was still close with Juan and Teresa after that moment, I was like, but why? Like, what made him come back? Like, that's the progress that I'm talking about. Like, I feel like everything that comes after that, and, like, it appears as though throughout the course of the movie, these two might be the only ones who know, like, openly from his mouth, like, the conflict that he's feeling.
Well, his mother certainly knows.
His mother... Well, can we talk about the arc that his mother takes in the first act?
Real quick, yeah. Though. So Juan's character, we don't really know how much Chiron interacts with him after the fact.
Well,
basically what we find out is as he's going through life as a teenager, he still interacts with Teresa. He still stays over there from time to time when his mom is just going on a bender. And she mentions that, you know, or actually it's Paula, his mother, that actually mentions, hey, you know, I haven't seen Teresa since the funeral. And we notice there's a distinct lack of Juan in the second part. And if you just put two and two together, you realize, you know, Juan was basically killed. He was taken away from this character, probably at a time when maybe Juan would have reached back out to him. We don't know. That narrative is just not filled in.
Bill,
and
I
so
think
we
it
can
is. I'm pretty sure that Teresa says that he and Juan were thick as thieves and like sows a lot of backstory for them having a continued relationship.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It might, but they were also, can you imagine that you're this girlfriend of this drug dealer? And all of a sudden, your boyfriend, whatever he is, just out of nowhere shows up with this young boy who you have dinner with and who you kind of unlock and you kind of get to know a little bit. And all of a sudden, the next day, he shows back up and he's there again and he spends the night with y'all. And, you know, all of these things happen. And in a very short amount of time, this kid becomes attached to y'all as a couple, as a group. I think in a very short amount of time, it's very easy to look at Little and say that he would have become very attached to Juan. His heart may have been broken, but it doesn't necessarily mean when she mentions y'all would have, or y'all are thick as thieves, she's talking about him in the past tense. She let that slip, and you can see how much it affects him. And I don't necessarily have to or necessarily agree that it was the indication that they had to have further adventures beyond that moment. I think honestly, that's enough in this young child's history of interacting with people that he would have made a huge impression. Because it's also the only positive male character role model that he has. He doesn't really interact with the teachers or things like that. We don't see that side of his life. And so I think Juan would have made a huge impression very early on in his life. And right. If he was taken away shortly after having that heartbreaking kind of situation, I think it would have been easy for them to kind of play into that. So
I hear everything you say, but I do not agree with you.
And that's fine. That's fine. And the narrative leaves that open, right?
If you say so. I have to. Well, actually, yeah, I guess it does, because again, this film is deeply disinterested in really filling in a lot of backstory. So yeah,
and
I think
part of that is because what it's trying to do is, unfortunately, and again, I hate to continuously bring up a lot of this stuff that I found out kind of after seeing the film and things like that.
Right,
but
because if it's not the text of the film, then it doesn't really have to do with our read of it.
But it does kind of play in at the same time. And basically Barry Jenkins' idea was that in these type of areas with these African-Americans, they often will have surrogate father figures come into their life very briefly and be taken away too soon. And
right, but I mean,
whether
like,
it's
wouldn't...
by drugs, whether it's by violence, whether it's by going to jail, things like that, they literally come in and then in a blink of an eye, they're gone. And it's kind of like, how do you deal with this as a human? How do you deal with this as a character? And that's what this story is kind of trying to track. And I definitely understand.
I see that, but I think that that particular read only matters to the film if they continued to have a relationship up until the point that he died.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just how I see it. I mean, to my eyes, at some point they reconciled. And I have to take a phone call from my wife. So one second.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
Right.
That's I finished what I'd said, thank God.
I
want to talk I deeply want to talk before we get into the final act and how we felt about that, about his mother, who I feel like is the biggest issue with this film. Like, she goes from just seeming fine to like a full-on monster in like the space of 4 days, and then continues to be awful until some point in the future in the third act. I mean, I had a lot of issues with that. I thought it was a little too neat that she was getting high in the car right next to the spot where she bought the drugs and that she happened to be buying them from Juan. And I don't know. I just like, I couldn't.
What do you think about that interaction though? Because to me, that was one of the most heartbreaking interactions, because he literally couldn't say anything, because he couldn't have the high road there.
It reminded me a lot of Half Nelson, if anyone saw that movie from a long time ago. God, I saw that when I was in college. Anyway, existential breakdown over, moving on. It was fine, but it was like a little too perfect, like a little too on the nose. It really it reminds me of what Michael was saying, where it's like it felt like at that point it was like clicking in and it was like, okay, this is this part, this is what we got to get through now. And whereas everything before that felt very, I won't say organic, because this guy so quickly taking an interest in this kid was a little weird to me, but I was able to get over that for the sake of like getting this relationship going. But that scene was just like, of course, like, she's the crack addicted mom who's like asking the drug dealer, like, are you going to raise my son? And then, you know, we talked about how a lot of this movie is how other people are reacting to who he is, even though he hasn't really figured it out yet. And I feel like his mom just saying something like, you know, are you going to explain to him why he walked that way? And, you know, why all the other boys beat his ass? It's just like, so she knows, and I don't know if she's struggling with it or she's disappointed or what, but she does like yell at him and call him a faggot, which is terrible, but it does lead to that great dinner scene. But you didn't have to have it be from her, or it could have been from her, but not because she's like on crack and basically starting to sell her body for drugs.
I do agree that like scenes, you know, where she's like, give me the money. I know Teresa gives you money. Like that scene was far less moving to me than, but like, I love this. I'm not sure there's really any other scene quite like it where the young Chiron, Alex Hibbard, I guess, is just in the bathtub.
Little
is just in the bathtub and like just react, and you can tell he's going through like this episode of self-loathing, but you don't obviously need his mother to be, you know, yelling in his face. I can understand where both of you are coming from here, but I think I do probably go more with Brian in terms of this one. But I'm not quite sure what her arc is meant to be, besides the argument, or not the argument, but the fact that it is, you know, based on a true life, and it's important that it's a part of this character's life. But I'm still not quite sure the way it resolves, and it just feels kind of odd. Are we supposed to infer that? So is that rehab at the end? Is that?
Yeah, she's in a drug rehabilitation facility.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's a shot of the visitor's tag on him, and.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't even see the visitor's tag. Shoot. All right.
Oh, it's very prominent.
Yeah, when
he lights. I mean, first you can see it when he's just sitting there, and then he takes her cigarette from her to light it for her, and there's a pretty obvious shot of it. I don't mean to be a dick right now, Mike. I apologize, but I do want to say,
no,
yeah,
you're fine.
Let me point out all the times that you should have seen this detail.
Wait, but Bill, I'm kind of curious. I mean, do you have, not to put you on the spot here or anything, I mean, what do you make of the overall arc with Paula, the mom character?
I don't necessarily have that many issues with her character because I think I'm more interested in Chiron than I am in Paula in this situation. So her character arc serving as a function to move the narrative along makes sense to me. Is it satisfying? No. Is it kind of frustrating at times, especially how on the nose and how, you know, it's like, whoa, super small world, you know, of all the crack dealers, she had to have him as the crack dealer and things like that. But what's interesting is as soon as she sees him, she doesn't like him, right? Yeah. When her first interaction with him is, I don't like you. And he's struck by that because he's like, well, I just did something really nice for your kid. I just took care of him, and like, I couldn't get any information out of him. What did you want me to do? But I think what I'm reading into that is that she knows who he is, that they have not necessarily history, but she knows exactly who he is. And so but he doesn't know that she's about to be in the thick of that, right? I think her character is supposed to be someone that's holding it loosely together with like a 9-to-5, or, you know, I mean, she's obviously like a night nurse or something like that, and it's more than likely it's not a 9-to-5, it's probably a 5 to 9 a.m. kind of situation. Sure. Right. So she's not there when he gets off of school, she's not there when he wakes up and goes to school, she's out, you know. So I mean, like, basically
you were saying if she helps to move the plot along, but like she only really does that once.
I think she also
She affects it multiple times. She affects it in that situation because she sows the seeds of anger in Juan, or in Little with Juan, and it kind of drives a stake between them at a very crucial point when that otherwise would have been kind of a beautiful relationship. That whole sequence at the dinner scene when he asks, so my mom does drugs, and he says, you know, yes, and he's like, and you deal them to her. After that, he gets up and leaves. Like,
right,
that is.
But then again, by my read, he presumably comes back.
And see, that's the issue, is, see, you read it one way, but ultimately Paula is affecting that relationship, right? Will you admit that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
okay. I mean that's the whole crux of their like. Otherwise, he wouldn't have much of an issue with Juan, right?
No, but I mean, like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's the one thing that she does. Like, she calls her son. Well,
so the second
thing. I'm not
going to
say it
again,
but.
Yeah.
Like, her
the
whole,
second thing. Okay.
I don't want to get bogged down in this. Like, I'm just saying, like, in my eyes, watching this movie, she is a wasted character after the first act.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you're not going to be able to convince me otherwise. And
okay. Well,
that's just how I read it. Well, we've been talking for an hour now. And we have a tendency to get bogged down in trying to convince each other of things like this. And no, I'm watching this movie, it's hard for me to understand the purpose that she serves after the first act.
So my reading is that the finale, when he visits her and she finally kind of is both accepting him and accepting herself. And it's not clear how much they've interacted, but it's definitely they haven't seen each other in a while. And she's finally come to grips with who she is. She seems to have kind of control of her life again. And she's accepting him for who he is. And that, once that happens, it's kind of the catalyst for him to basically realize that he's going to accept himself and then meet up with Kevin. So again, she's affecting the plot in that way, because it's got to go through that narrative of she's being a piece of shit to him. But the whole time he's trying desperately, otherwise he wouldn't stick around. He's trying desperately to win her love and affection. And he finally gets it when she's clean and sober and realizes how much she affected him. And so in that way, it kind of allows him to accept his own self and then go meet up with Kevin.
That is a beautiful read that I did not get from the text of this film.
Yep. Okay.
Mike was gonna say something.
I don't know what to say about the mother guy. It always just keeps coming back to the sense that this movie just sometimes feels, you know, retroactively plotted to me. Yeah. That we need to hit these things, and you know, sometimes it's a really rich experience, and other times it's, you know, hitting that moment. Bill, like, going along with what you're saying, I guess it's important that last time when we meet her in rehab as well, so she can, you know, bring up her own jealousy about Teresa as well. So we get that one more time that, hey, this woman who was a bad mother, you know, not only that, but she's been replaced by this person who has another role in her life, and also how she reacts to, you know, her son being, you know, a drug dealer now, but, or being a dealer now, but it's still those things just feel odd to me for some reason. And I still just can't quite articulate why. And I guess it just bothers me.
Well, because her addiction feels completely disconnected from him in any way. She's an addict, and it doesn't really feel like it comes from or in any way relates to who he is. That's how I saw it. Like, that's how I read it. Like, why are we checking in on this other movie happening when this kid's got so many more interesting things going on?
I would agree that I don't really think I didn't see the growth narrative that Bill was seeing. I mean, I do see that she influences things, but I think I wanted this is going to be weird. I think I wanted this to be more of a coming out narrative. I think I wanted more of that.
I was fine with it not being a coming out narrative. I'm like fine with a lot of this movie in terms of like the idea of it, but like the execution for me is where it kind of falls apart. Like, I'm fine with this not being about a guy who decides to, like, dance in the next Miami Gay Pride Parade, or even, like, decides to, like, just pursue a relationship with someone. I'm fine with this movie just being about observing the life of a man who's struggling with his homosexuality and having to learn how to code switch. And maybe, sure, maybe he lives his entire life, you know, closeted and dies with a family that he never really was meant for. That's fine with me. Just do it well. And this movie, I don't think, does it that well. And so that's where my issue comes from. That's, mm-hmm, you know.
Well, I don't think it's, that's the weird thing about it, is I don't think it fully works as a coming out narrative. I don't think it fully works out as this other story of code switching, as much as I like, you know, the ways that, you know, he's putting up a front, or the ways that he denies his own identity. I like those things, but neither, I can't connect those two organically in my head.
His front at the end, like this new life that he's pretty much built around concept of masculinity and a lot of the little images that he's maintained of Juan in his mind, it doesn't really even feel like it's code switching. I mean, he's not walking around pretending to, you know, be hooking up with every woman in the world or anything like that. I mean, he's, sure, he just seems, yeah, like he's a lonely introverted, yeah, guy.
Yeah, code switching, I'm sorry, is probably kind of inaccurate as I think about, yeah, it. But,
and so that's, but the weird sense, it's, of, it's not a code switch narrative. I don't think that it really, the movie makes any judgments as to who he has become. It's really just,
but it's about the opacity of his identity as well. So that's the weird part, because it's about this to an extent. So it's not, right, really doing, I can't really fault it when this is very much its purpose in terms of, you know, how I'm supposed to read that.
Right, like, so the question that ends the film, one moment, Bill, and then we'll get to what you're, okay, saying. The question that ends the film is, who is you? And
yeah.
Yeah, it's like that feels like an ending thesis statement, and then he kind of tells Kevin, you know, who he is. And then it's over. And, you know, who he is isn't anything deeper than we've seen this entire time. And it doesn't feel like he's ever in denial of himself. And it also doesn't feel like he's finally being more honest with others about himself. So, like, I don't quite understand.
Well, right, Bill, I mean, we don't get to see what happens after him and Kevin, basically, because it's at that point that Kevin accepts him, right? Chiron is finally has someone to reveal himself to, and in this crucial moment, Kevin, who just earlier he wasn't sure if he was going to accept him or not, now fully accepts him, and they're embracing each other. You know, I think one thing that's nice about this is it doesn't show them fucking each other at the end. It shows, sure, them just simply embracing, and yeah, yeah, all that I need to see is that to understand that they maybe, what it's basically is it's him kind of seeing Kevin as this guy that's just embraced himself, right? He's found happiness in being a cook, and found happiness in kind of a simple, he calls it like a Bob Marley kind of existence, and he's found happiness in just kind of the simplicity of life. And Chiron's like, I want that. I want to be able to just embrace what I am and not have to put up the front, not have to have these fucking retainers in my mouth that, you know, give me a false grill and all this other bullshit that he's basically putting up. And I think, you know, when y'all are talking about how and it is unfortunate that it doesn't kind of wrap it up a little bit more on the nose, I guess, for you in particular, Brian. But for me, that's what I kind of read away from it, was, man, like, all I need is just them to embrace each other, and for them to know that Chiron basically has someone that now he can finally talk to. Because before, I mean, he's got all of this masculinity around him. He can't be that thing that he wants to be openly in that situation, right?
He's put himself in that situation.
Sure. What other option? I mean, we don't really see him have a lot of option. Yeah.
He goes to jail presumably after clocking a kid with a chair, which was the best moment in the film.
And yeah, he definitely goes to jail.
Yeah, jail or juvie or something. But like, yeah. I loved that. I loved that moment. I was like, this guy is finally like acting, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, okay, now we're seeing him now, and he's huge. He's mm-hmm. like, I was distracted by the amount of muscles on that man. And as he's talking to this guy who's under him in terms of his little drug dealing franchise, I don't know what to call it, he seems mm-hmm. pretty fine. And he's the most talkative and relaxed that we've seen him in a while. Mm-hmm. And so it half felt like it was going to say, like, he had been making himself, like, less of a target as a hope of not being a target. And now he's just decided to swing the other direction and made himself the type of guy who's like a target who can hit back. And he seemed more comfortable that way. Like, he seemed more supremely comfortable in that car, blasting that music, doing those push-ups and rocking those fronts than he did wearing skinny jeans and a shirt. Like,
sure. And look, it's interesting because we get to have this masculine identity, and there's always the narrative, and I think it's kind of a cliche narrative of the gay person being effeminate, right? And sure. It's like they have to be small and frail and they can't defend themselves,
especially in the black community. Yeah.
Exactly, because that's exactly what's put on. And what's interesting is for much of this kid's life, right? For 2/3 of this film, we get maybe 5 or 10 words out of this guy, or sentences out of this kid, right? Yeah. And what is better? Look, like I lift weights, and you know, I have kind of a bulky look to me, and immediately when people see me, a lot of people just assume certain things about me. Right. They just look at me and they just assume certain things about me.
Traveler from the 1920s and escape from your strongman show.
And so, you know, it's interesting because in a way he's giving a front where he doesn't have to interact with people. People aren't going to fuck with you when you're like 6'2" and you're like 230. Right. Like, people are just going to look at you and be like, okay, that's enough. Like, I'm not. And his whole life, he's been bullied. He's been picked on because he's been tiny. Right. And so he gets out of juvie and he starts to get jacked. You know, we don't know if he got jacked in juvie or whatever, but it's like, no, he's putting on a front in multiple dimensions where A, it's both a masculine identity. It's something he's also comfortable with because he finally has that kind of power and that ability to just be like, quit fucking with me. I don't have to actually talk to you. I don't have to act, because we don't ever see him interact with anyone in a rough demeanor, right? He kind of jokes with one of his guys.
I love that scene so
much.
And
he tells him the count's wrong.
Yeah. And but we don't see him ever get put on blast by anybody, right? No. That is in his history. And part of that, I think, the way I read it, is just simply because of the way he looks. Like, people are just going to be like, all right, you're a grown ass dude and you're jacked. Like, why am I even going to bother messing with you? Yeah. Right. And then you add the drug dealer kind of front, you add his teeth, you add the chain, you add the music, you add the car, you add the swagger, you add all of that other shit. And yeah, definitely people aren't going to kind of mess with you. And it enables him to kind of hide. Right.
Right. And again, we're getting bogged down in details. I mean, the one thing that I wanted to kind of pull out of that is, like, is that not himself?
is what not is
that
himself.
Physical embodiment, like, but do you think that his physicality in the end is a betrayal of who he is, or do you think it's a better way for him to be who he is?
I think it's finally him being able to, like, embrace his ability to defend himself without having to actually do anything necessarily.
Right, but again, like, that is that who he is, or is that him? Is that a betrayal of who he is, or do you think that that's a way for him to be able to be who he is?
I don't know him as a person, so I don't feel like it's a betrayal. What I'm saying is, like, I literally don't fucking know this guy, and
right,
like I could watch an 8 hour.
Him, you should. I know.
But what I'm saying is, I could watch an 8 hour movie, and I still wouldn't actually feel like I know someone, right? So you're asking a very deep and personal kind of question, like, okay, is his outward masculinity a betrayal of his inner character? And I just don't know, but I don't feel like it's a betrayal of his character. I don't necessarily read that. So,
right, I don't think it is. I think that that is allowing him to be who he is.
Yeah.
So, Mike, do you have an opinion?
I would have to agree with Bill that I don't think I'd be able to judge that from the snippets, from the episodes that we've seen of his life.
Now, would you say that that is a failure of the movie?
I would, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting way, honestly, to tie up this conversation, to ask that question and then see the differences, because, like, this movie is obviously an exploration of his gay identity and then how that fits into his black identity. And I think that it's strange that at the end we see him being more of I don't want to say the word thug, because it's been polluted recently, mainly because of the election, but you see him being the uber masculine idea of
he's black more identity. Stereotypical.
Right. But at the same time, he has never looked more comfortable. He, as a child and as a person in high school, is, like, wilting and cannot assert himself. But now, because of this, he is finally able to, like, just be.
I read it as a betrayal, but as you speak more about it, I am unsure.
Well, because, and that's what I said, like, is it a betrayal of who he is, or is it something that allows him to be who he is? Because, like, if I were to, I am not a man who's in good physical condition. If I were to suddenly become Bill level fit and strong, I think that that is not a betrayal of who I am on the inside. Now, if I were to, I don't know, fucking... What's something that's iconic about me that I would have to betray?
Your Irish metaphors.
If I were to, let's say I were to become a full-on neo-Nazi, that is a betrayal of who I am. Now, there's, like, a strength and a menace to that, but it's not the same that just comes from making myself the type of person who doesn't have to worry about other people thinking about me so that I can remain who I am. So I think that at the end, that masculinity that his friend, lover, Kevin, calls a front. Well, no, he doesn't call that a front. He calls his literal fronts a front, the gold teeth. I think that it is, like, his way of being able to be who he wants to be without having to worry about reprisal. I think that that is not a betrayal of who he is. I think it's an affectation that allows him to be who he is. Because he's still, at heart, the same guy.
Uh-huh.
He still goes and sees his mom. He still has trouble meeting people's eyes. And
all of these...
Again, he's not, like, living with a woman. He is alone. And he just doesn't
have
to worry about
it. But all of the things he's done as a way to combat all of the expectations around him.
Right,
so by the very fact that he needed to change himself, even if we don't know exactly what that you know, principal self is, by virtue of the fact that he's changing it at all, isn't he betraying himself?
I don't think that I think betrayal is more of like lying to himself about who he is. And I don't think that he is. I think that he has.
Well, he is until the phone call.
But it's hard to know because we see so little of his personal life. But he's not like living in an apartment with posters of like women everywhere or like a woman in general. Like, he appears to be living an asexual life. I think that he hasn't repressed his desires because he hasn't gone out for anything else. I think that he's denied them, but
he is still talking shit with that kid when they're in the car.
But is that like wrong?
No, it's not necessarily wrong, but I think you'd have, I don't know if I can quite get behind what you're, the more I think about what you're saying, I don't know. I mean, like, just because he is able to camouflage himself doesn't mean that he's enjoying himself. And again, we are, as you're saying, we potentially don't get enough to really answer one way or the other.
The main problem of the movie is that we don't know. And unlike Bill, I feel like spending an entire movie focused on a single character in this way, by the end I should have a pretty good idea and be able to answer that question. And I feel like I have an answer, but I can't be sure. And that, for me, is one of the major failings of the movie.
Well, that's just the ambiguity you described, though.
Exactly. I don't know if that's coming from necessarily his lack of dialogue, right? Or if it's his lack of character development in the film, because one and the other pull on each other, right? Without him directly saying certain things, we don't get an insight into his brain. This isn't a novel, right? We don't get him talking to himself in the inner monologue or anything like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So the only things that we really have to go off of are two things: what he says and how he looks in certain situations. Right.
But my argument was just that how he looks is not an indicator of who he is. And I think that it's possible that, like, while he has undergone an incredible physical change, he does say at the end, like, you know, you're the only man that's ever touched me. Like, there's not been anyone else. So we know that he hasn't pursued that part of himself, but I don't think that just making him have those trappings is enough to say that, like, he's really, like, gone back on himself or that he's betrayed himself.
So one thing I do want to mention before we kind of wrap up this, and I know we're kind of running long. I want to mention the way it's shot. I don't think I really heard very much of what y'all thought about the film, but I thought the film was beautifully shot. And I also noticed a big emphasis on soft focus, where basically the background in a lot of sequences is out of focus, and it's mainly on the subject itself, whoever is in the foreground, and that's about the only thing that's in focus. I'm not sure if that was done in post or, you know, if they actually achieved that effect in camera, but I thought that was pretty interesting. I mainly picked up on it during Black's kind of sequences, because a lot of the things in the background we're supposed to be kind of paying attention to. And, you know, I noticed often it was out of focus, and it, you know, it's obviously intentional the way that they shot it. And then I also just want to ask y'all what y'all thought about the music itself.
I didn't find this movie to be aesthetically worthy of praise or derision. I thought it was whatever.
Okay.
Michael, did you have any aesthetics?
I like the vibrant ways that this film uses color, and I like the ways that it develops a visual rhythm and callbacks and things like that. But I, honestly, the visuals are a major part of why it's my biggest internal conflict about this, is the fact that the narrative feels so structured and the visuals are from a different movie. And
this movie feels a lot more vibrant and alive than that actual narrative is.
That's what I'd say. Like, it's just, you know, it's there's things I should be praising here, in the sense of, you know, the 360 degree that starts the film, the 360 degree turn that where you know, we start with Juan and we end with Black, you know, where it's Little, where there's a 360 degree turn around him. And, you know, there's camera movements in here. Yeah, it's very well directed, but the visuals are things that my opinion of visuals is embedded with my own issues with the way that the movie actually becomes a movie.
Right. And then the music is the same. I think that the piece that we hear in the trailer is fine, but it's not particularly important to the narrative. I mean, when it comes down to it, like, if I can't hang with the movie's narrative, the aesthetics and the music choice, I mean, those become secondary. And unless they're crazy or particularly artful, they just kind of melt, and that's how they've kind of done for me.
I like how there's like a fragmentation to the quality of the ways it's playing, you know, with like classical music and our understanding of that. But a lot of times it just kind of sunk into the background for me.
So he's got kind of like a musical kind of motif throughout the film that kind of repeats, and it warps at each individual kind of character and stuff like that. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's fine. if the narrative isn't working, things like that aren't going to make it better. Now, it's like cooking. You know, if the meal isn't good, it doesn't matter what kind of ingredients you put into it. But if it's fantastic, then everything will meld together and it'll be transcendent. It'll go more than the sum of its parts. But like, at this point, you know, good lettuce on a bad burger ain't going to make that burger better. And
sure.
Yeah.
But in my kind of viewpoint and things like that is, even if I don't necessarily enjoy a film, what I usually try and pull away from it is something positive about like what the film ultimately is. And part of that is going to be the music, the way it's shot, you know, certain things like that. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from, is I was hoping that even if y'all didn't enjoy the film necessarily, that y'all would be able to notice some of those visual touches, because like, let's be honest,
I don't think that they're good enough to rebound.
Sure. And I did. And so that was just kind of my through line, was to ask. But, you know, like, if you had a pretty shitty burger, but maybe the bun was badass, might not go back to that restaurant, but you might be like, let me get the name of that bun. Like, what was the ingredient there and stuff like that?
That's not how that works. That's not how that works at all. No. Okay. No, it's just not going to happen. Like I said, like, and it's not even like it's not even like the aesthetics or the music were like super great. They're just fine enough, and they didn't feel of a part with the movie and the narrative we were watching, and they weren't excellent enough to elevate the movie at all. So for how fine this movie is, they can only either be fine enough for it or not fine enough to like drag it down. And they are fine enough for this movie, but they neither added to nor diminished my opinion of it.
I unfortunately have to agree. I'm a little more positive than Brian, but I'm in a similar place when it comes to the visuals and the aesthetics.
That's not unfortunate. That's just your opinion.
Like, no, I mean, I do.
Mike just hates to agree with me.
No, we've been agreeing about a lot lately, Brian. It's weird, but
it's getting freaky. I'll be honest.
But it's just like this time of year becomes difficult because you have read about. I mean, if you're following movies, you've heard about Moonlight for going on, what is it, 6 months now? Was it TIFF?
Yeah, or like Venice or something. Sure, Venice feels like TIFF. It's been forever,
and it's been months and months. And you know, you don't ever want to, you know, be like.
It kind of premiered at Telluride.
I wanted that rapturous experience, and I didn't have it. So I'm a little bit sad about that.
I will say that I made a big point about how I wasn't reviewing this movie against the hype. If I was reviewing this movie against the hype, I would be furious.
Hmm. Well,
I would just add more to the hype.
Yeah, like if I were, well, you know,
but let's put this in context real quick though. You, Mike, you basically said that it's dealt with months and months of hype. It literally had its world premiere September 2nd. That's bonkers to me because it does feel like it's been a while, but the reality is it's been basically 2 months.
I've been in the foxhole, Bill.
Yeah.
That's crazy. No. It feels like I've been hearing about this movie for years. No, if I were reviewing this movie against the hype, I would be furious, but I decided, you know, I was going to tune it out. I went and saw it. It was about what I figured it would be. And I mean, that's fine. It's a fine movie. And like I said, it's heartening that we're getting narratives like this. And I look forward to the one that does it a little better, that can dig in more, that can like really fucking bury itself beneath the surface and give me something like, this doesn't feel like a movie that I haven't seen before. And given its subject matter, it should have, and it's just fine. It is just C plus B minus fine.
To bring it back to a movie, did you guys have any, or I don't know whether I was alone or just what I was expecting, but I was very surprised when it ended. I thought it was very abrupt.
Yes.
Did you guys have any feelings about that ending? As much as it's poetic on its own, I couldn't help but leave and think, wait, that's it?
That's like, exactly that's how I felt with Carol, honestly.
See, I really like Carol.
No, like when it ends, my body is when a specific kind of movie is coming to a close, I can sort of feel it, and I either say, please end now, or please don't end now. And oftentimes I am super disappointed. For instance, The Gray. At the end of The Gray, I was like, oh my God, if this movie just ends in the next 15 seconds, it's going to be perfect. And it did, which is great. Now, Carol, that movie, I was like, I swear to God, if this is the ending, I'm going to be pissed. And it was. And I was not happy with that. This movie, I was never drawn in enough to care about when it ended. I didn't feel like I wasn't sunk into this person's life. I cared about Carol and where it ended because I cared about those characters and what was going on to them. And I was super disappointed that like that was the end. Like, I felt like there should have been something more. This movie, I was like a jellyfish just kind of being pulled along by the tide of it. And then it was over. And that was fine with me.
Yeah, I mean, I've already kind of mentioned a little bit of the ending. I thought it was perfect the way it ends, because I was really into the third part, especially with Kevin, and that interaction that they have, I think is just the perfect note to just kind of end the film on for me. So
I would have loved if you had just killed Kevin.
Well, Kevin fucked up his life.
Like,
yes, and it's funny, at one point, he kind of hangs around his car when Kevin is walking into his apartment, and one of my friends kind of leaned over and was like, did he just grab a gun? And so that entire sequence, that entire finale sequence really had a different tone that I was just like, uh-oh, I didn't notice that, but maybe. And, you know, he mentions you're the only one that's ever touched me. And I'm like, oh, shit, here's the moment.
I think it would have been interesting if this movie had ended with him killing Kevin. It didn't, obviously, so it's not worth talking about. But
yeah,
it would have been a more familiar narrative, though.
It would have
familiar narratives.
I hate that fucking Kevin is just like so excited that he's there, and he's like, "Hey, man, yeah, we're best friends." And it's like, "Fuck you, Kevin! Like, this is your goddamn fault, Kevin. What do you think you're doing, Kevin? Who are
Look
you?
Look what you
have
did, you little jerk,
life, Kevin." Like, I just wanted him to like, and maybe that's it. Maybe he really hasn't changed. Maybe this is who he is. Because like, if he were the man that he appears to be, he would fucking bring Kevin to task for kicking the shit out of him after having his first like gay encounter with him, and then like, you know, he goes to jail because he doesn't hit Kevin, because he hits the guy who made Kevin hit him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just, you know, like, there was a point in this where I was like, fuck Kevin, don't go see Kevin. I wanted him to like not go to Kevin and then go over to his boyfriend's house or something. Like, there's, I guess that's a, we could have a whole other podcast about my issues with like his choice to go see Kevin, but just mm-hmm. accepting that, I was like, all right, whatever, this isn't great. Okay, so that's all for Moonlight. We have been talking for an hour and 46 minutes, which is
Fuck
basically
Kevin.
As long as the film. We've got to stop doing this. Let's tell the fine folks at home where we can be found right after I do a plug for MUBI. I'm so tired. We're doing this super late because Mike was lost.
I'm sorry,
in New York,
guys.
Or something. I can't even.
Oh, I was in the suburbs.
I know. But for some reason, having said Kevin so much, it made me think of Home Alone.
What's hilarious is we got a message from Mike basically saying, I'm in the suburbs, as if that was an SOS signal that we should have known about. Like, oh, shit, he's in the suburbs, which means he's definitely lost. Like, we should go send a search party out for him. I was what does that even fucking mean?
I'm in the suburbs. And he sent it at like 4. And like, our plan was to do this at like 8. And he's like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that. I'm in the suburbs. Like, I live in the suburbs of D.C. I can be in D.C. in 12 minutes.
Yeah,
like, don't give me that shit, Chicago boy.
Yeah.
And then some asshole on his subway had to like get carted out to go to the hospital. So that asshole delayed us even more.
Fuck you, Kevin. That guy's name was probably Kevin.
Probably Kevin. Probably. I should mention that my brother's name is Kevin. So
is your brother an asshole?
No, he's not an asshole, but he's a fuck up. And so I've had a lot of experience saying Kevin in like the most dismissive, hateful ways possible. So MUBI is the curated online cinema where you can see some of the best foreign and independent works around.
This is my favorite part of the weekend.
Currently at the end of Horrific October. So if you would like to see the movies that have been coming out through that, you should go to MUBI.com/filmstage and go check those out before they disappear. But don't fret, because every day we introduce, well, they introduce, I'm not a part of MUBI, they introduce a brand new cinematic gem for you to enjoy for 30 days. You can download them to your phone and watch them on the go if you're like Mike and you're stuck on a subway train that's being held hostage by a man who needs to get taken out on a ventilator.
So, how dare him?
How dare he? What is he doing? Like, what was that? I don't know why I sound like I'm really angry at this man. What was that son of a bitch doing?
Ryan, you need to go to bed.
I do. I am so tired right now. My wife was calling to say goodnight. Because I told her I was going to try to go to bed by 10, and that obviously did not work.
Sorry.
Okay. Anyway, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found in between now and the next time that we yell at them. Bill Graham.
Bill?
Sorry, guys.
Bill Graham.
I have... I had my microphone on mute, so y'all couldn't hear me clicking around. Yes, I can be found on Twitter at CableBFG. I can also be found writing about movies on the Film Stage and also FreshFiction.tv. And I should have that interview with Trevante Rhodes up soon.
Okay. Nice. Michael Snydell.
You can find me at Snydell. I'll be watching all my horror movies in November instead. And you can read things from me. I have Atlanta recaps at Paste, and I'll have a bunch of reviews coming soon, and an interview with Logan Lerman and Sarah Godone for the Indignation DVD release.
All right. I'm too tired to come up with anything clever to say. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find my personal site, dearfilm.net. I have revamped it. I have made an attempt to begin writing there again. I have a review of Monster, the newest film from Brian Bertino, who I mentioned on the last roundtable about The Strangers. That is all. I should have an interview coming up with a director soon. It was supposed to be done this weekend, but we delayed. So we'll see about that. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.
Dancing in the moonlight.